headlines this hour. Israeli forces shoot and kill a Palestinian youth near the city of Al-Bira in the occupied West Bank. Regime forces also clash with Palestinian resistance fighters in Tulkarm. Russia and Ukraine intensify the cross-border attacks, with both countries reporting the downing of a number of missiles and drones over each other's territory. And in the U.S., thousands more auto workers join an ongoing strike against major car manufacturers over pay and contract issues. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have killed a young Palestinian man and injured another in their new attack in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media have said that regime forces ambushed the young man and opened fire at their vehicle near the city of Al-Bira. One of the victims, identified as Mohammad Romane, succumbed to his injuries. The Hamas resistance movement says Romane and his companion were its members. He said in a statement that he was a hero and was killed while trying to defend the freedom of Palestinians. Palestinian media report confrontations between Israeli troops and Palestinian protesters in various areas of the West Bank, notably in the city of Tulkarm. In Ariha, a Palestinian youth was injured with Israeli fire. Palestinians today are observing a general strike in Ramallah and other regions in the West Bank. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil told us more about the latest Israeli brutality in the occupied West Bank.
The military declared that two Palestinians arrived at the entrance to the illegal settlement of Pesagot, built on the lands of Al-Biri, adjacent to Ramallah, and that they threw Molotov cocktails at the Israeli military checkpoint there, and thus the Israeli forces opened fire, killing one and wounding the other. Mohammed Jibril Mani, 18 years old, was shot and killed. His friend was wounded, and both were arrested. The body of Mohammed, of course, was confiscated by the Israeli forces, and the military declared that he succumbed to his injuries. Hamas movement issued a statement later saying that Mohammed was one of its members, and he supports Hamas, and he was killed while defending the Palestinian lands and trying to face the Israeli forces' brutality.
After 58 days of a hunger strike, a Palestinian held in Israeli jails is facing an increased and imminent risk to his health. That's according to local NGO, the Palestinian Prisoners Society. Kayat Fasfous has been relocated from Ascalon prison to the notorious Ramla prison clinic due to severe health setback. The 34-year-old is on a hunger strike to protest his indefinite detention without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. This marks his second imprisonment, having previously spent nearly 7 years in Israeli jails. There are nearly 5,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, including 160 children. Some 1,200 of them are administrative detainees. The UN chief has called on Israel to release the administrative detainees or to bring charges against them if any exist. UN journalists working for alternative media from across the globe have gathered in the Iranian holy city of Mashhad to attend the International Khorshid Media Festival. Some 100 journalists and media activists from more than 40 countries are in attendance. This year's event has been dedicated to slain Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was murdered by the Israeli regime last year. Earlier, our correspondent Kisumi Shahmadi joined us from the venue to tell us more about the event.
The main goal of this media festival is to allow a platform for journalists and independent journalists in particular to connect and network and to be able to connect to each other in order for future cooperation with other outlets across the world and Also, another issue is to see exactly what's happening on the ground in Iran, particularly the situation of women in Iran. Of course, the title of this first media conference is Women and Enlightening the Future Generations in Public Opinion, and that is a focus on how women play an important role in shaping public opinion. So I've been talking to journalists coming from different countries across the world, from Latin America, from Africa, from countries from the Far East, such as Indonesia and China. We have journalists coming from Russia. For most of them, it's the first time they are visiting Iran, so it's quite interesting for them to see how women journalists work in Iran, and of course about how much freedom they enjoy and the challenges that they face. They're also sharing their own experiences as women journalists working in their own countries. For example, journalists coming from African countries have been saying that watching Iranian journalists work in Iran is quite inspiring, considering the obstacles and challenges that women journalists face in Africa. Also in Kashmir, we had a couple of journalists coming here and sharing their experiences. Then also there are some panel discussions on the sidelines of this first media festival, which are discussing media itself from different aspects and the fact that mainstream media is trying to set the narrative by highlighting some parts of the truth and ignoring some other parts for it to fit in the narrative that they want people to believe.
Russia and Ukraine intensified their cross-border attacks, with both reporting the downing of a number of missiles and drones over each other's territory. The Russian Defense Ministry says its air defense downed all 9 missiles launched from Ukraine over its western Belgorod region. The ministry accused Ukraine of terror attacks. Belgorod borders Ukraine's Kharkiv and has repeatedly targeted since Russia began its military operation in February of last year. Meanwhile, Ukraine claimed to have shot down 30 out of 40 drones launched by Russia in an overnight attack. No details were given about 10 other drones, but a Ukrainian official said an infrastructure facility was hit in the Vinnytsia region. Ukraine has stepped up its drone and missile attacks on Russia since June. Russia says it has repelled most of the attacks, downplaying their significance. In the U.S., thousands more auto workers have joined the ongoing strike against the country's 3 major car manufacturers over pay and other issues. The biggest U.S. automobile workers union says that walkouts now leave a total of some 25,000 workers on strike in 21 states. The latest union members who joined the industrial action are at 2 plants in Chicago and Michigan. This is the first ever joint strike at Ford, GM, and Stellantis, known as the Big 3 Detroit automakers. The union says sufficient progress has not been made in the talks. It has asked for a 40% pay raise over the next 4-year contract, while the companies have been offering just 20%. Hundreds of thousands of workers in various sectors have walked off their jobs this year, ranging from Hollywood scriptwriters and actors to nurses, hotel staff, and pilots. Income inequality amid soaring prices has been cited as the main reason. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The U.S. inches closer to a government shutdown after the Republican-led House fails to approve a bill to temporarily fund the government. More than a dozen Republicans voted against the party's own stopgap bill proposed by their leader, Kevin McCarthy. They joined all Democrats that also opposed the measure due to deep cuts to the government programs. The Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has warned that a likely closure would undermine the country's economic progress. The government will shut down on Sunday if no agreement is reached. It will trigger the furlough of hundreds of thousands of federal workers and would halt a wide range of government services. It would also leave troops without pay. Fry Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Santiago de Compostela. We also have Hassan Yunus, who's an economic analyst, joining us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Fry Hughes, let me first start with you. So we're looking at what appears to be another instance of party wrangling in the U.S. Now, we could discuss whether it's the Republicans that are at fault or the Democrats, But leaving that all aside, how much of a danger does that put the U.S. economy when you have the threat of a looming shutdown?
I think that's the most important question that you could possibly ask. This is about kind of interactions between the two political parties. But the main effect is going to be for the people who are on low incomes, the people who are living from check to check, the people who may lose their homes if they default on their mortgages. So while the Republicans are threatening to bring the country basically to a standstill, all the politicians will continue to be paid, as will the president. There will be no financial impact on any of them. Many of them are millionaires. And yet the most vulnerable people on the ground in America are at most risk of the government coming to the financial government coming to a shortfall. But what we're really looking at is the Republicans trying to force their political ideology onto the incumbent government and Joe Biden. And I think the Ukraine is actually the basis of all this. Republican voters no longer want to support Ukraine, American money going in a money laundering scheme where arms and money is sent to Ukraine in order to be laundered and sent back to the military industrial political corporation in America. So the vulnerable people will suffer, and the millionaires and the billionaires will be laughing all the way to the bank. So I hope this doesn't happen. I think it's horse trading. I think basically what we're seeing is leverage being applied by several individuals in the House of Representatives in order to further their own political interests and their own political careers.
Well, Hassan Yunus, looking at this purely in terms of the economic aspects of it, it's quite incredible when you take a look at the amount or the share that the government actually contributes when it comes to the U.S. economy. I think it's upwards to 25% that the government has expenditures that contribute to the U.S. economy. So that in itself is a rather huge amount for it to all of a sudden be taken out of that economic output. What type of impact will that have, if the shutdown occurs?
Thanks a lot for hosting me. Actually, the 25% which you've mentioned is an unhealthy indicator to be contributed by the government. The government expenditures have to be for some investment purposes, not only for expenditures on such purposes that I'll be mentioning and that will be impacted by the U.S. Government Saturday midnight deadline to stop funding of the federal agencies, which is the fourth shutdown to occur over the past decade. Actually, this will hurt the American families. It will have an impact on key governmental functions, including loans to farmers and small businesses, food and workplace safety inspections, and other major infrastructure improvements will be affected. So, for example, 1.4 million active duty members of the military and tens of thousands of air traffic controllers will be among those working without pay. Before listing the other impacts, this has a negative influence on the perception of the U.S. economy, on the perception of the U.S. brand, especially amidst the rivalry with the BRICS, with China in particular. So this is giving the Republicans an upper hand before the upcoming U.S. elections. So on another note, it will have an impact, for example, on the special supplement nutrition program for women, infants, and children, on museums, national parks, research facilities, and communities' health centers, with federal government oversight or funding, are likely to suspend operations. As well, with the global warming, we're witnessing lots of hurricanes, lots of earthquakes all over the, especially in the Atlantic. So the agency at the helm of relief and recovery from natural diseases won't receive funds in case something happens. So can you imagine the negative impact with which this might have, even if the issue is resolved? As I've said, from a branding perspective of a country, the harm is there. It has already occurred.
Very well. Thank you so much. Let me thank Farahiz, journalist, author, and activist from Santiago de Compostela. Thank you there, Farahiz. And Hassan Yunus, economic analyst there from Beirut. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. pilots of Canada's biggest airliner have staged a protest in the city of Toronto to demand better pay and benefits as talks over a new contract continues. The Air Canada pilots are pressing for higher wages and better scheduling. Currently, their union is engaged in negotiations with Air Canada, and it anticipates that these discussions will persist throughout October. The company's previous decade-long contract ends on Friday. The new contract would cover 4,500 pilots. The protests come after U.S. pilots working for several airlines achieved historic gains in new labor deals over the past few months. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for tuning in. It's bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and Fars Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 11, 2023. We said that the U.S. is becoming weak. The Western arrogant powers are becoming weak. This is not a slogan. It is a reality. It is something that they are saying themselves. They themselves say that the indicators showing the authority of the US in the world are declining. What indicators? An example is their economy. One of the most important indicators of the US power used to be a strong American economy. They say it is declining. Another indicator is the ability to interfere in other governments. The U.S. interfered in various governments. Their ability to do this is on the decline today. This is happening in European countries in one way and in other countries in another way. You hear about this in the media, in the news on television and radio, and in the world news. They admit to this. One of the indicators of the authority of the U.S. was their ability to change governments and countries. Pay attention to this. These are important matters. There was a time when the U.S. sent an agent to Iran with a suitcase full of money with dollars. The name of that agent has been recorded as well, and everyone knows him. Kim Roosevelt. His name was Kim Roosevelt. These are not secrets. They were secret back then, but they were revealed later on.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They sent an agent to Iran with a suitcase full of money, and he fomented a coup, the 28th of Mordad coup. With the conspiracy of the US and England working together and at the hand of an American agent who brought money here and distributed it among thugs and mobs and various other people, they fomented the 28th of Murdad coup. They overthrew a government, Mossadegh's government. That is how America used to be at one time. Can the US do the same thing today? Definitely not. It cannot do this to Iran or any other country for that matter. Today, the US has no choice but to use hybrid warfare in order to inflict harm on the governments it wishes to harm. Hybrid warfare entails great expense and it will ultimately bear no fruit for them.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Mali is a historically renowned African country that gained independence in 1960 after years of struggle against French colonial rule. Now, 63 years after independence, Mali, just like many of its African neighbors, is still struggling to end French domination. Since attaining independence, this West African country has been afflicted by several rebellions, insurrections, and coups, some backed and instigated by former colonial power France. Now, the current government of Mali came to power in May 2021 amid an anti-France wave in the country. The people of Mali have had enough of French neocolonialism and now want true political and economic sovereignty. Due to popular demand, French troops have been ejected from Mali, but this colonial power is intent on striking back. Mali had to cancel this year's independence celebrations after attacks by separatist rebels in the northern region of the country. So, who is behind the current insurgency in Mali? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In this week's episode, we are focusing on the situation in Mali as the country marks 63 years of independence from France. The second segment of our program is on the recent decision by Burkina Faso to expel the defense attaché of the Embassy of France from the country. The expulsion came following intelligence reports that he was carrying out subversive activities.
Mali resisting French imperialism. Mali's famous northern Timbuktu city that once served as a major intellectual hub of Islamic civilization is once again the focal point for terrorist organizations operating in the Sahel region. Due to the worsening security situation, the government of Mali cancelled festivities planned for the anniversary of the country's independence celebrated on September 22.
Well, for more on the situation in Mali, we have contacted David Houndane. He's the founder of the West African Weekly. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Timbuktu, the historic city situated in northern Mali, is under threat from foreign-backed terrorist organizations. This comes just after French President Emmanuel Macron said Mali, Burkina Faso, or Niger would have disappeared if Paris had not intervened militarily in the Sahel. Now, are we seeing a common pattern here of France creating a pretext for reoccupying Mali after its ejection from this country?
So, yes, you would have to say that that certainly looks to be the case. As is very well known, of all the colonial powers to have ever operated in Africa, France historically has always been the most unwilling to let go. And when it is forced to let go, it has historically been the most vengeful when it is letting go. So, for example, the way it basically trashed the entire country of Guinea when the country voted for its independence in 1958, I think that is still something that is in the memory of most people within Francophone Africa. Secret intelligence agency, the DGSC, is actually one of the most active on the African continent, particularly in North Africa and the Sahel. They have a lot of resources in that region, so it's actually not beyond the realms of possibility.
The renewed military activity, allegedly by the Tuareg separatists and terrorists in Mali, came after the ejection of French troops from this country. The question that arises here is whether imperialist France is striking back following its ouster in Mali by encouraging separatists pushing for the Balkanization of Mali.
I think that is definitely a real possibility. For those who may not know, France has actually done worse than that in the past. So a few seconds ago, I alluded to what it did in Guinea before it was forced to leave the country. Basically, before leaving the country, the French occupying colonialists made sure that the country was essentially sabotaged from day one. They salted farmland, they poisoned water sources, they burnt down government buildings, civil service buildings, they destroyed hospitals, roads. You know, the colonial administrator famously made a comment that there mustn't be a single functioning typewriter in the country of Guinea by the time they leave. That's how vengeful historically the French have been when they are forced to leave a country that they are illegally occupying. So France potentially being behind the resurgence of terrorist violence in Mali is actually not the worst thing it has done. So it definitely is within the capability of France. It definitely is something France can do and has done.
Armed groups from northern Mali claim that they captured some parts of this region. This has increased fears of the collapse of a peace deal between the ex-rebels and government forces. Meanwhile, United Nations mission in Mali, MINUSMA, is gearing up for a significant milestone as it readies itself for its scheduled withdrawal from Mali on the 31st of December 2023.
Al-Ghassim Wayne, the head of MINUSMA, recently briefed the UN Security Council on the situation in Mali. Let's take a listen.
Parties have adopted diverging positions regarding the fate of camps to be left by the mission. Here, the transitional authorities have signalled to the mission that they themselves intend to retake MINUSMA camps following the mission's withdrawal.
Now, Mali cancelled Independence Day celebrations this year after deadly attacks by insurgents in the north. The country's interim president, Assimi Goïta, says the anniversary will be celebrated in sobriety following attacks that have left dozens of people dead. Now, what's your take on this decision?
Well, I think it's a relatively sensible decision. I think it's a pragmatic decision. And I think it signifies that the regime currently in charge of Mali, at the very least, understands the severity of the task that lies ahead of it. So instead of hiding behind sort of empty triumphalist signaling, the regime seems to understand that there is a lot of hard work ahead. So basically, it doesn't really make sense to waste time and energy on, you know, unnecessary fippery and signaling right now. So the message that he put out, in my opinion, was exactly right. It's a time for sobriety and it's a time for looking forward, for looking to the task ahead, instead of patting yourself on the back for what thus far has been a largely symbolic series of events. The real revolution, if you like, is still ahead. It still lies ahead. The majority of the hard work still lies ahead, but the good news from an African point of view is that it seems as if the regime in Mali at the very least seems to realize that. So that's definitely a good thing.
Mali needs international assistance in confronting the security challenges it faces, it's quite clear that previous French intervention in Mali did not end terrorism, but actually led to an increase in attacks.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov visited Mali in February and was warmly welcomed in Bamako as the West African nation seeks military help for its fight against armed groups. Lavrov said defense ties between the two countries are improving.
Last year and the start of this year, cooperation in military and military technical areas was given a new page in their development. A large consignment of Russian aviation technology was sent, thanks to which Mali's army was able to conduct successful operations against the terrorists who remain active on their territory.
Well, that's Lavrov there speaking. Now, Mali has turned east in efforts to end insecurity in the country. Now, is this a prudent decision?
Violence is actually worse now than it has ever been. Then clearly, it means that at the very least, that partnership or whatever it is with France clearly hasn't worked. So it's time to try something new. So even if it's not the case that it's actually France that is instigating the violence, and it's not actually France that's behind it, at the very least, you'd have to say France, the partnership that France has been completely useless from a Malian point of view. If the violence is actually higher, it's more serious now than it has ever been, the death toll now is higher than it has ever been, then of what use is the so-called military partnership with France? So it definitely doesn't make sense that they would look to another option, right? And it so happens that the only other option right now is, you know, the option that lies eastward, be that Russia or China. So I think that's the pragmatic thing to do. That's what I would do if I was in their shoes. I don't really see that they have any other option.
Mali exported 69.3 tons of gold last year, compared to 63.9 tons in 2021. These statistics are an indicator that the interim government in Mali, led by Assimi Goïta, is moving in the right direction. It appears that France is unhappy with this progress and therefore intent on messing up this country.
I definitely do agree that France definitely is not happy with that. And the reason is very simple. If for anyone who knows a thing or two about international economics or geopolitics, you'd know that France's position as a first world country, as an economically advanced and economically developed country, is almost entirely dependent on this thing called Françafrique, right? The 14 nations across Africa, which France basically maintains a colonial grip on, via, you know, the plethora of, you know, lopsided agreements that it has with them, and the economic crime known as the CFA franc. For those who don't know, the CFA franc is essentially colonial money, which 14 African countries, including the likes of, you know, Mali, you know, have been forced to use. So if individual erstwhile members of Françafrique are starting to break out of that toxic colonial relationship and are proving that when you break out of Françafrique, you will actually do better economically, that's very bad news from a French point of view, because it means that the other nations within Françafrique are going to, you know, get clued on very quickly that there is life outside of France.
Under Mali's new constitution, passed overwhelmingly with 96% of the vote in a June 18 referendum, French is no longer the official language. Now, the move is seen as a clear blow to France. Well, our last question to you. Now, what, in your opinion, are the political and cultural implications of this decision 63 years after independence?
Now, what's the potential, what the act of dropping French as an official language potentially means is that going forward, there's a possibility that Mali and any other, you know, country in Françafrique which follows in its footsteps and drops French as an official language can explore the possibility of potentially adopting possibly English or, you know, another language which enables it to have wider access to the world. I think this is definitely a step in the right direction for Mali, and I think the rest of Françafrique should be paying very close attention to the results that Mali will post in the coming months and years as this effect of sort of weaning itself off that toxic dependency on France, basically, especially the CFA franc and the use of the French language, what results that this is going to have on the French economy and on French integration, on the Malian economy, sorry, and on Malian integration with other economies in Africa. I think other countries in France-Afrique should be paying very close attention.
While indeed it appears Mali is moving in the right direction by ending its toxic ties with France, I'd like to thank our guest there, David Hundain, founder of the West African Weekly, for his incisive analysis. And we now take a short break before our next topic on how France is yet again meddling in Burkina Faso's internal affairs. Stay with us.
France meddling in Burkina Faso. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Relations between Burkina Faso and its former colonizer France have continued to worsen since a popular September 2022 military takeover.
In the most recent incident, Burkina Faso's government ordered French embassy's defense attaché, Emmanuel Pasquier, to leave the country due to subversive behavior. Many people in Burkina Faso perceive France's military presence in the country as a failure, as it did not improve security in the insurgent-hit West African country. Regular protests take place in the country where citizens express their sentiments against France.
Immediately, nous voulons pas ambassadeur français au Burkina comme Luc Allard. Luc Allard représente comme Satan au Burkina. Il représente comme pyromane, comme terroriste. Nous voulons pas ces genres d'ambassadeurs. D'un ambassadeur terroriste, c'était un terroriste. Nous voulons pas ces ambassadeurs. Il n'est pas autorité au Burkina à l'air.
To discuss the escalation of tensions between France and Burkina Faso, we have contacted Abdullatif Ahmed. He's a senior Nigerian journalist. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Burkina Faso has ordered the French defense official to leave the country for engaging in subversive activities. Do we have indicators of exactly what acts of subversion this French defense attaché was engaging in there in Burkina Faso?
The indicators are not clear. They are not in public view. Most times they are based on intelligence reports that have been actioned upon and been sent to the government. Don't forget that Burkina Faso, like other French-speaking African countries, are continually escalating their anti-French sentiments. And apart from ordering their French representatives to leave their countries, there is a chance that from what the signals they've gotten, from the conversations they've had, from the interactions that the ambassador has with people within the country and outside the country, there's a chance that Burkina Faso feels that Mr. Emmanuel has to leave the country. So there may not be indicators that are in public view, but I suspect strongly that there are intelligence reports or signals to the government of Burkina Faso that suggest that Emmanuel Pasca needs to leave the country.
During France's military presence, Burkina Faso turned into one of the poorest countries in the world amid a growing presence of terrorist groups affiliated to Al-Qaeda and Daesh, which killed thousands of people and triggered a humanitarian crisis in the country.
The government of Burkina Faso now says it will collaborate with new partners to restore security.
This might have been informed by the activities of French troops across the region. It is expected that, considering the heightened terror attacks, insurgency in the Sahel, the support from the French troops was meant to subdue the terrorists, reduce their impact and their activities across the region. However, what we have seen over time is that there has been rising and worsening security situation in the Sahel. So while we may not be sure of France's obtrusive diversionary activities, you know, within the region, what the argument is that the presence of France or the French troops in, you know, the region has not improved the security situation.
Burkina Faso is rich in mineral resources. In fact, it is one of the leading producers of gold in Africa. French companies have looted these resources for decades and kept the economy of France alive while the people of Burkina Faso languish in poverty.
Now, next question to Mr. Ahmed. Now, will Burkinabes benefit from their country's wealth under the current government, which is popular due to its anti-France sentiments?
The fact that, you know, the French have been, they've given a cold shoulder to the French and they are seeking alternative partner, suggests that there can be better, you know, negotiations of, you know, bilateral agreements or trade agreements to ensure that they have better pricing for their products and not the pricings that, the French were used to before now. Again, just the fact that the French presence in, you know, in these countries have continued to impoverish, you know, the citizenry. It's not just about the French, but the quality of leaders that engage the French. Because again, as it is said in, you know, in Africa, nobody can cut your hair without your approval. So where are the leaders in these countries when the when French investors, for example, give them the shorthand of, you know, the negotiations?
Burkina Faso is among African nations that have recently turned to other foreign powers such as Russia and China to combat terrorism on their soil in an effort to find a long-lasting solution to security challenges. The people have declared support for the country's collaboration with Russia to restore security.
Le peuple burkinabé demande le soutien de la Russie pour l'accompagner dans cette lutte acharnée qui nous a été imposée. On a besoin de tous les collaborateurs. Si la Russie peut faire notre affaire, elle est la bienvenue.
There are great expectations that such a move will provide a solution to security challenges.
There is a new direction towards the east, that is China and Russia. It is expected that the Russians and the Chinese troops that are coming in, for example, will look at alternative ways of dealing with the security problem. What it means is there has been solutions or ideas that were being used in the past that has not been as effective as it is expected. Those strategies will be reviewed, hopefully. Those strategies will be looked at, and an alternative strategy will be brought about. That is my expectation. Beyond that, you will have realized that the Russians and the Chinese do not interfere in the governance process. They do not interfere in the politics of the nation as compared to Western powers that would want to dictate certain things to, you know, the country, considering the fact that they are the colonial masters of Burkina Faso and other Francophone countries.
Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger recently announced the formation of a military alliance to counter external aggression. Mali's foreign minister elaborates here.
Toute atteinte à la souveraineté.
Any attack on the sovereignty and territorial integrity of one or more of the signatories will be considered aggression against the others, and it will entail a duty of assistance and relief on the part of all signatories.
De toutes les parties.
Now, last question to Mr. Ahmed. Are we going to see a bigger anti-France alliance in the region, and can it be transformed into a formidable economic and political bloc?
That alliance is welcome, as I said, and is expected to forge a common understanding. Why is France today seen as the enemy of the region? It is because of France's obtrusive activities in the region. It is because of France's, you know, inordinate political, you know, interferences within the region. If you are coming to offer security protection and help, stick to that and leave the country to run on its own. So, yes, you know, the alliances are fine, but it simply having anti-France rhetoric does not solve a problem. Simply complaining about, you know, a problem doesn't fix it. So there has to be an independent alternative thinking to how to fix the problem, because, again, France is only offering help. If France cannot help, then, you know, those within the region should be able to help themselves.
Well, there you have it. Alternative thinking is the key word. Former French colonies in Africa, such as Burkina Faso, are charting their own independent path. I'd like to thank our guest, the Abdul Latif Ahmed, for his insight. Well, and that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers, dear sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salaamun Alaikum, and so welcome to this program of Lantern with a new story. Dear brothers and sisters, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have an interesting story. Let's listen to it. Let's listen about Hassan impresses an unbelieving neighbor. Hassan once fell sick. His neighbor, an unbeliever, came to pay him a visit. "Oh, Imam," he exclaimed, "I detect a bad smell." The imam told him it was caused by illness, but the neighbor insisted, "That is not the odor of sickness. It is a lavatory smell. For the love of Allah, tell me what it is." He had not noticed that sewage was leaking from his house into that of the imam. When the neighbor pressed him, the imam finally said, "For some month, your drain has been seeping through to our side. I tried to fix it, but without success." His neighbor asked why he had not told him before, but the venerable imam said, "I might have offended you." The unbeliever was so impressed by this ethical refinement that he was ennobled with true faith, for he recognized the imam's morality as a ray of Islam. That was all for this part, so let's shift to the explanation and the important points of this new story.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then take some moral lessons out of these stories in order to make use of them in our daily life. Well, our subject for today's episode is about the way our religion has recommended us to treat our neighbors. You know, in the religion of Islam, the good behavior towards neighbors have been so much emphasized that there is certain rights for neighbors even. You know, the Arabic word jar means neighbor, and it is used in several implications in the Holy Book of Quran as well. In some places, it is used to refer to neighbors close or far away. In the Holy Book of Quran, it is also used to refer to those who seek asylum, as in the following verse. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وإن أحد من المشركين استجارك فأجره. If one amongst the pagans asks thee for asylum, grant it to him. Surah At-Tawbah, verse number 6. You know, the above word used for neighbor has the deeper meaning of security. That implies that neighbors are granted security by each other. The right of a neighbor is great both intellectually and religiously. Consider this verse of the Holy Book of Quran. وَعْبُدُوا اللَّهُ وَلَا تُشْرِكُوا بِهِ شَيْئًا وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا وَبِذِي الْقُرْبَى وَالْيَتَامَى وَالْمَسَاكِينِ وَالْجَارِ ذِي الْغُرْبَى وَالْجَارِ الْجُنُوبِ وَالصَّاحِبِ بِالْجَنْبِ وَابْنِ السَّبِيلِ وَمَا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُكُمْ. Serve God and join not any partners with him, and do good to parents, kinsfolk, orphans, those in need, neighbors who are near, neighbors who are strangers, the companion by your side, the wayfarer, and what your right hand possesses. Surah An-Nisa, verse number 36. The verse refers to some of the rights in Islam, including those of neighbors. You know, neighbors who are near in this verse has been interpreted by various commentators to imply various things. Some consider it to imply to relatives. However, since the verses that have preceded this verse in the Holy Book of Quran refer to the rights of relatives, this interpretation seems to be unlikely. Rather, other implications seem to be more appropriate. It may mean neighbors who are closer to you in religion. Neighbors who are strangers implies physical distance. According to traditions, people living in up to 40 houses away in either direction are considered our neighbors. It may also refer to non-Muslim neighbors who are not fighting with Muslims. Now that we have studied the Quranic verses regarding neighbors, we will briefly review the traditions on this issue after having a short break.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRIB English Radio. We are talking about neighbors and how much they have been emphasized in our holy religion. The Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, stated that Jibra'il recommended to me about the neighbors to such an extent that I thought the Almighty Allah would appoint one's neighbor as one of his ears. He also stated, whoever believes in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Ma'ad, or the Day of Resurrection, never does injustice to his neighbor. lends him money if he asks for it, and shares his grief and happiness. One should not annoy his neighbor even if he is an unbeliever. He also states that he who hurts his neighbor will not smell the fragrance of paradise, and he who disregards the rights of his neighbor is not my follower. Whoever has had enough to eat and does not help his neighbor after knowing that he is hungry is not a Muslim. Okay, dear listeners, that's the time we've got for today's episode. Thank you very much for being with us today. And until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
In the advice Imam Ali gave to Imam al-Hassan and al-Hussein after the accursed Ibn Muljam had wounded him, he also talked about neighbors. Imam Ali, in his last maxim, in his last will, he talked about the right of the neighbor. He said, be mindful of your duty toward Allah regarding your neighbors, because it was the advice of your prophet who continuously talked good about them, about neighbors. Until we, meaning we Muslims, who heard the hadith, we heard the talk of the prophet about the significance of neighbors, till we thought that he might, the prophet, he might give them a share in our state, in our inheritance. He talked so much about neighbors that we thought, as our kids, our children inherit us after our death, they inherit our assets, he may give a share to the neighbor. That's how close the neighbor is to us. And that's how respectful and accommodating we need to be to the neighbors. That we thought he talked so much that we thought he may inherit us. حَتَّى ظَنَنَّا أَنَّهُ سَيُوَرِّثُهُمْ. So, and by the way, the Prophet didn't say, if your neighbor is Muslim, then reach out to him. If he is non-Muslim, don't reach out to him. No. He said, your neighbor. Be nice to your neighbor. Be it Muslim or non-Muslim. It doesn't matter.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
The Colonization of the Mind with David Miller.
Part 2.
In all the years since the revolution in 1979, Iran has been limited, sanctioned, and under pressure. As a result, much like Russia under Putin, Iran has pushed towards self-sufficiency and has prioritized technological developments.
We're in a period where Iranian military technology is becoming a serious force in the world. And that, you know, didn't happen overnight. I mean, as I've walked around this museum, you know, one of the key things you see is the lack of technology at the beginning of the war, the poor equipment of many of the soldiers. And as the war goes on, you see the development of the technology. The sanctions cause the development. I mean, it's just like with Russia. You know, the idea that we could, a year ago, sanction Russia and that would lead to the collapse of the Russian economy, a coup against Putin, and the dissolution of the Russian Federation. That was clearly a monstrous miscalculation on behalf of NATO. But of course, it's a monstrous miscalculation because Russia is now a country which is self-sufficient in most things. And the sanctions are the mother of invention, of development, of the economy, but also of military technology. And when you have to develop, rise on the world stage in a way which it is probably nobody expected outside Iran.